Hello, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to Bookomi. We're here to get smarter, faster, together with original, memorable insights, or OMI, from books by the most wanted minds in business, science, technology, and culture.
Hello, my name is Noreena Hertz, author of The Lonely Century, and this is my OMI for Bookomi.
In this episode,
we're living in a state of loneliness. Many of us are, and that's having huge ramifications for our health. Loneliness is as bad for us as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
We meet the economist, strategist, and best-selling author whose vision for the future cuts through the constant change and social division tearing society apart today.
I see loneliness as personal, as well as political, economic, as well as societal, driven by technology, but also by the individual choices that we make.
Youngsters looking for connection through a mobile phone to the old men clinging on to the inequalities that keep them in power. It's time, she says, for us to come together and fight the forces that divide us to rule. In The Lonely Century, coming together in a world that's pulling us apart, Noreena Hertz examines the impact of loneliness on societies, economies, and individuals, costing millions of lives, billions of pounds, and, as Hertz puts it, posing a potent threat to a tolerant and inclusive democracy. Noreena, welcome to Bookomi.
Thank you, Rich.
How would you define loneliness, and are we getting better at measuring it?
Great question. So I think loneliness in some ways is like pain. People have different experiences of it and it has different drivers, but it's still meaningful to talk of one thing, loneliness. And the main drivers or the main experiences are, as we might think when we think of loneliness, feeling isolated, feeling bereft of friends, company, love. In the United Kingdom, 2 in 5 pensioners say that the television is their main form of company. In Japan, pensioners are so lonely that they've seen a spike in pensioners going to jail because they're intentionally shoplifting so that they're jailed and have a place where they can find community. So there's loneliness as isolation. And then there's loneliness as feeling invisible and ignored, whether it's the loneliness of the city dweller alone in the crowd where everyone's rushing around them, the loneliness of the office worker eating al desco alone, or also the loneliness of feeling ignored and disconnected, not only by our friends or colleagues, but also by and from our fellow citizens, our employers, the government, even ourselves. So I see loneliness as personal, as well as political, economic, as well as societal, driven by technology, but also by the individual choices that we make.
And like you, I grew up with regular bouts of tonsillitis. We have that in common. And I moved from primary school to primary school and had to forever make friends. And it gave me a visceral aversion and an allergy almost to sensing loneliness in other people. I can't bear to see people being left out. It actually makes my pulse change and my breathing quicken. And you talk about the physical manifestation of loneliness in the book. Isn't though it just what you call a brilliant evolutionary feature in us that we respond to loneliness? So it's actually a sign that we're alive. So in a way, it's a positive thing.
Yes, to the extent that, you know, right way back when, we were designed so that we hunted together with other people, so that we were in communities in order to protect ourselves. And so loneliness was something we experienced as a kind of warning sign so that we would connect with others, seek out others, not live our lives by ourselves. So in that sense, it actually is a positive thing. But in order to alert us, what that means is that our blood pressure goes up when we feel lonely, our cortisol levels go up, our stress levels go up, our heart rate beats faster. And all of these things, whilst great for a very short period as a way of alerting us to effect change, isn't great when sustained for over time. It's a bit like a car. If a car is put in first gear, that's great initially. But if you're driving a car repeatedly in first gear, that's going to significantly damage your engine. And that's what we're doing. We're living in a state of loneliness. Many of us are. And that's having huge ramifications for our health. Loneliness is as bad for us as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
And COVID kind of helped that. And the more connected we are, well, we're hyper connected now digitally. Do you think that's led to more opportunities to disconnect? You know, the more connected we are, ironically, then the more opportunities we have to feel left out of networks.
Well, yes, technology plays for some. It is a way of connecting. And obviously, the LGBTQ kid in Idaho who never had met anyone like them, who's been able to find community through a Facebook group, is more connected thanks to social media, say, as is the Filipino migrant worker who's able to FaceTime with their friends. So, obviously, technology, social media can play a positive role in connecting us. But when it comes to loneliness, there's been a clear march in lockstep of the rise of loneliness and the adoption of technology. And what we see, especially amongst young people, is that from 2011 onwards, we see this kind of steady increase in loneliness reaching ever higher heights. In the United Kingdom, nearly half of children aged between 10 to 15 feel lonely often or sometimes, nearly half, which is really striking. And technology clearly playing a role there, because initially, when I saw this research as an academic, my first question as an economist was, well, clearly there's correlation, but is there causation? Are we more lonely because we're using social media? And initially, and actually up until about a year ago, there wasn't research that really helped answer that important question. But just over a year ago, a couple of very seminal studies were carried out. And in one, there were a few thousand people, in this case, students. They were half the group was actually told to stay off social media for a period of time, stay off Facebook. And the researchers looked at how this group felt as a result of changing their behavior and how their behavior changed. And they compared it to the control group. And what they found was that the group who had stayed off Facebook was significantly less lonely and also spent significantly less time online as a whole. It wasn't that they stopped being a, that they went off Facebook and then migrated onto other platforms. They didn't. So we can see that there is this link between loneliness and social media quite empirically, and there's been a couple of other studies with similar findings. And I think the reason why our phones make us so lonely is because, firstly, they make us much less present with each other. And this is true, of course, of us as adults as well as teenagers. The smartphone has become in many ways our mistress and lover. We cheat in plain sight, and yet we've all come to accept the infidelity. And not being present with each other and with the people around us obviously makes us feel more lonely.
It's ironic, isn't it? Because we all want to belong. We all want to take part. We all want to be accepted as who we are. And that desire for belonging, when it's weaponized, as you call it, by a political party, for instance, it intensifies our distrust of other groups or beliefs. And that's where we are now, isn't it? We're constantly being asked to take sides and to mistrust each other, where we've, as you put it, normalized a discourse of divisiveness, distrust, and hate. I mean, that's powerful stuff. And is that really just from feeling lonely that and marginalized that we have this terrible weaponized situation where we can be turned against each other?
And obviously, there are a number of factors that account for the rise of far-right populism in recent years. But one of the factors that I think has been pretty much ignored up until now and my new book is the role that loneliness is playing here. And for this book, I interviewed people who were voting for right-wing populists across the globe, and their shared experience of loneliness was something that came across time and time again. There was Eric, the Rassemblement National voter, the young baker from Paris, who told me of how much community he felt when he was hanging out with other Rassemblement National members and going leafleting with them and going out afterwards. And he told me of how lonely he would have felt had he not found community within this group community, the community which, of course, in the past might have been offered by a trade union or by a kind of workplace with regular hours, or by a community centre, or even by the church. Those kind of traditional hubs of community, of course, being eroded. Or Giorgio, the small businessman from Milan I interviewed, who is very passionate about the Italian party, Salvini's party, the League. He also told me about the solidarity and the camaraderie that he felt was missing in his urban existence, that he had found in the dinners he went to, where they would sit around the table and sing traditional songs. And, you know, I think right-wing populists in particular have very effectively spoken and are speaking very effectively to this sense of isolation and marginalization and abandonment. Abandonment was a phrase that came up time and time again in interviews with right-wing populist voters, a sense of being abandoned, left out. Populists have proven masterful in speaking to this and in really delivering community. If you think about Trump rallies with everyone chanting songs and wearing the same kind of red MAGA hats, or if you think about Vlaam Belang, the Belgian far-right party's events where they will have inside speeches or anti-immigrant and outside face painting and bouncy castles, or Spain's boxes, beer nights for under 25s. What we've seen is that right-wing populists, better than centre parties and centre-left parties, have really weaponized community and targeted the lonely, seeing them as a group who are likely to be more receptive to their message, especially their message, not only their provision of community and not only their message of we the people, we're listening to you, but also their message of you are lonely because others are taking from you. And there was a fascinating piece of research done with mice, where researchers had isolated a mouse for a period of time, and then they put into its cage a new mouse. And what they found was that the longer the mouse was isolated, the more vehemently it attacked the new mouse put into its cage. And it's really a case of mice, of men. The lonely are more susceptible to conspiracy theories, more likely to see the other as a threatening force. And right-wing populists have played to this, and that's and will continue, I believe, to do so.
What your book does, I think, amazingly well, and it's one of the first books I've read to tackle this problem meaningfully from the kind of macroeconomic point of view as well. I think Vivek Murthy's book, Together, you know, the Surgeon mm-hmm. General in the US, he's sort of skirting around, well, he's not skirting around, but he's tackling the same issue and redefining. We started this conversation about with a redefinition really of loneliness, rather than it being someone, you know, we think of loneliness in a slightly romantic way sometimes. Mm. But you pick up on the socioeconomic anthropological point of view, seeing your loneliness as someone who has no place in society and someone who's alone at the heart of that. And that's one of the most striking things I find about the book, is that you overlay that idea onto everything that's happening at the moment and where we've come from. And it can make you feel somewhat despairing.
But Rich, you know, this isn't a despairing book.
Don't worry, I was about to pick myself up from the well of despair, and I was about to say how much hope it gave me as well, because it actually gives some sort of reason. Because I think a lot of the problem we have, people who care, people in a democracy who, as you say, you know, are willing to sacrifice something for other people, we worry that the world's just sort of irrational and unreasonable and has gone wrong. But what you do is you present a template for recovery, really, because you have to accept what's wrong before you can move forward, don't you?
Yes. And hopefully I don't only expose the problem, but also the book is full of things we can do to reconnect and come together, and ways that we can come together again, whether at an individual level, a business level, or indeed at a state level, at a government level. And the book really is full of things we can do on all those fronts. So, you know, we may have built a lonely world, but now we have the opportunity to rebuild the world with community compassion and care at its heart. And I think the coronavirus makes this more urgent, but also more possible.
And in the section on the loneliness economy, you talk about Glastonbury with almost nostalgic reverence for the muddy togetherness that people once felt. But you're quite critical also of businesses that fabricate community and togetherness. What Emile Durkheim called the collective effervescence of being together, you know, the excitement of doing things with other people, which a lot of us are denied now. So WeWork, for instance, and you talk about lots of co-working spaces and the concept of co-working spaces, but WeWork's bubble burst just before the pandemic, really, because for all sorts of reasons in terms of its leadership, but it was almost a craze for other companies to get into that co-working space, wasn't it? I mean, every building seemed to be turning into a co-working space, and I couldn't help feeling like, are there enough workers to co in this place? You know, you look at these huge buildings, you think, are there that many freelancers? And then you scratch the surface a bit and you realize that it's being used by corporates for sort of office extensions, and it's really the front end, the shop window, are kind of hip co-workers who aren't really engaging in any community whatsoever. And the lid got slightly lifted on that. I'm not saying they're not, you know, some places are great and busy and exciting and vibrant, but there was no way the scale and the rate of that growth could be matched by the people who wanted it, surely.
Well, so one of the things that I tracked over the past few years is the rise of what I call the loneliness economy, which is an economy that emerged in order to really meet the need, the fundamental human need for connection and community that we have and that people weren't feeling. And we saw it manifest in so many different ways, really kind of very quickly. We saw a significant rise in the number of people who wanted to have these shared experiences, go to gigs, go and do escape rooms with their friends. We saw it in the rise of fitness groups like SoulCycle, fitness companies where people would exercise together in kind of commune together almost. We saw it in South Korea. There was kind of this wonderful example of these things that sprung up called Colatex. That's the word is a mixture of discotheque and cola, where pensioners would dance in the daytime, kind of daytime discos for pensioners, where thousands of pensioners would come each day to dance in the day to have community. So, you know, across the globe, what we had seen up until the pandemic, of course, over the past few years, was this significant rise in the loneliness economy, of which co-working and co-living spaces were examples too. And I think there is and will continue to be arguably even more of a desire for these shared communal experiences after the coronavirus. And right now it's quite hard, as we're still in the eye of the storm, to perhaps even imagine a time when we are able to come back together and hang out together and be physically around lots of people. But, you know, inevitably there will be either a vaccine or better treatment or better testing. And if we even think back to the 1920s, so just a few years after the 1918 Spanish flu, we saw bars packed with people and jazz clubs packed and nightclubs packed. And even if you were looking at countries where things have reopened, I mean, we're looking at Hong Kong, as soon as gyms were allowed to be reopened, you had queues around the block of people wanting to exercise together. So I think we will see a re-emergence of the loneliness economy, probably in an even stronger form over the next few years. But that, if I now may come back to kind of the important point that you raised here, the community that is commercialized needs to be authentic. You can't create community from the top down. You can't just stamp community on a product and expect people to feel connected to each other. And I think that's what you were speaking to when you mentioned WeWork, because, and you know, its IPO didn't fail because there wasn't a demand for these kind of co-working spaces. It failed, as you say, for a whole host of reasons, but they definitely used community big time as a selling point in their failed IPO prospectus. They mentioned community 150 times, the word community. And yet, if I think of my experiences visiting WeWorks, I remember visiting the one of the kind of flagship WeWorks in Tel Aviv. And, you know, there were a queue of people waiting to partake in the free food offering that was being given, in that case, a dish called malabi, which is a Middle Eastern rose petal kind of pudding. And so there was free malabi on offer, and people, you might have thought, a way for people to come together and chat, but instead people were standing in a line, all looking at their phone, not communicating to each other as they waited for their malabi. And then they were taking it, grabbing it, and sitting down at their desk and eating on their own. So, and in one of the living spaces that I looked at, you know, in a way had a similar some of the members had a similar complaint when they would put on their free salmon and bagel brunches in order to get people to come together and commune. Many members would just grab the bagel and salmon and take it back to their room. So community isn't, we can't what I call wewash and use community as a marketing tag. If organizations and businesses are serious about creating community, they have to do this in an authentic way, and importantly, give voice to the members themselves. And one of the most successful co-living spaces that I looked at, a company called Ven, which has actually tracked loneliness amongst its members and has found a significant reduction in loneliness, they're really consciously look at ways that they can get members to co-create this experience. And one of their most popular events is actually a kind of potluck dig-in dinner where people come together, bring their own food, make their own food, and through kind of sharing their food, talk about themselves and open up. So I actually believe that community is something that the market has a role to play in providing, but it has to be authentic, and that's key.
One of the many inspiring things I found in the book was the idea that independent, authentic communities, local businesses, retailers and retail outlets might have a better future because of COVID, if they can weather the storm. Because at the moment, it feels like only conglomerates with huge, deep pockets will be able to weather the storm. And then the smaller outfits like Mission Pie in San Francisco that you write about with great affection, they disappear. But those that you inspired me, actually, when I was reading it, I just went around the corner to our local coffee shop that literally opened the week of lockdown. A great place, gosh, you know, run proprietor led. And I just thought, you know, it's one thing wanting the market to do something. We need to do something as well. We need to act. We need to sort of start challenging our own value system and what we value in life. We need to start challenging the time we spend looking at our phones rather than the time we spend looking at each other, don't we? It's a real wake up call. Yeah. Everything's a wake up call at the moment.
You're absolutely right. And I think one of the things that, and I will put myself in this category for sure, one of the things that many of us who see ourselves as global citizens who spent most of our time pre-COVID traveling the world and in many various cities, I think many people like that, of which I am one, forgot perhaps that even in a global world, we need to nurture our local environments and our local neighborhoods. And I think COVID has been a real wake-up call for many people in that way. And yes, you know, on the one hand, it may be that as city centers and the center of town is less populated and empties a bit, local communities will benefit in local high streets and local independent stores. But the danger, of course, is that no physical environment benefits and that everything moves online. And you know, if we just look at kind of the massive acceleration of digital commerce over the past few months, we have two forces actually happening at the same time. We have this rise of what I call contactless, something which had already, of course, begun before the pandemic, but which the pandemic accelerated. So, you know, the ease at which we can Deliveroo and eat at home and not frequent our local cafes and buy on Amazon and not use our local bookstores. I think we have that trend happening at the same time as people are realizing more and more that actually those human interactions and our local communities really matter. And there was fascinating research done in America where researchers had looked at instructed people going into a coffee shop to either have no exchange with the barista when they bought their coffee or to actually positively engage with them. And what they found was that even what I call micro interactions, that hello you might give to your dry cleaner, or the kind of little chat you might have with the barista, or that smile when you walk into your bookstore, your local bookstore, with the local booksellers, all of those sorts of micro interactions play a huge part in making us feel happier and also more connected to each other. So yes, you know, this is partly about governments doing things here and business rates for local high streets should, I believe, be significantly reduced in order that local stores have a chance to survive the double whammy of e-commerce and now the economic downturn. And there are other things governments can do. In Belgium, one place has had real success with an empty shops tax, which incentivizes landlords then to rent out their shops at lower rents. But there's also much we can do. We can shop more locally. We can smile more as we walk by people. And I appreciate that's harder behind a mask, but maybe nod and say hello more. We can be kinder to those around us. You know, care and compassion and kindness were traits that, you know, in recent years were really undervalued, and we can consciously make an effort to be kinder. And yes, we can be more present with each other, put our phones down, look at each other in the eyes, interact face to face.
You're an economist, Narina. Can we really change the, much as we want to, you and I sat here talking, but can we change the calculus of capitalism, as you call it? Is it when we've got icons of self-interest in power, banks in particular, our leaders are not particularly known for their altruism, or indeed, you know, their compassionate capitalism. If that is the culture in which we operate, how do we see a way out of it? I mean, there's obviously we can act on a local level. I know some amazing projects around the country, community shops that are being developed by local people to as community centres, as touch points, like those micro points that you talk about. There's some fantastic ones. There's one up in Church Fenton in Yorkshire that is being used as a template now to teach other people how to do it, you know, to convert that post office that had kind of got a bit run down, or that empty shop. And it's actually saved the village. It's actually created a new sense of life and vibrancy and connection in the village. That surely will ripple out regardless of who's in power. But the culture that we're in is still one that we've grown up in through the 80s, where greed was good, you know, self first. How do we change that?
Well, firstly, I think it's important to recognize that there always have been different types of capitalism, and that the neoliberal dog eat dog, me first, consumer versus citizens model is actually relatively new. It came of age in the 1980s. Only, and that there always have been different forms of capitalism, the Asian model of capitalism, the Scandinavian model of capitalism, so models that work very well when it comes to innovation, but have put community and collective interest at their heart. So I think that's important to recognise, that perhaps the period we're in now is an aberration rather than a necessity. I think also if we look back in history, we can see that there have been these moments in history of shared difficult experiences, after which politicians have actually taken very bold and big steps, whether it was the National Health Service, which here in the United Kingdom was set up, of course, in the wake of World War II, or whether in the United States we're talking about Roosevelt's New Deal, which had, you know, huge projects aimed at addressing feelings of abandonment and inequity and injustice and limited rights that so many Americans had. So difficult and challenging times like these, you know, can and historically have served as a catalyst for change. And of course, there's a role that business leaders can and should play here too. And we have seen, even, you know, just before the pandemic, so in the months in the run-up to the pandemic, there had been a kind of more conscious voicing by significant corporate leaders of a need for a more compassionate, what I would call cooperative, perhaps, capitalism. And we saw business leaders from, you know, a whole host of some of the biggest American companies who are members of what's known as the Business Roundtable actually say the business of business should no longer be Milton Friedman's famous edict business, but actually should be to serve the wider stakeholders within which businesses are located, whether it's citizens or the local community or the environment. But of course, talk is cheap, and now we need decisive action. And we did see some companies do, you know, some very moving things during the coronavirus. Microsoft, for example, they decided right from the start that they would continue paying their kind of low pay contract workers, the cleaners, people who kind of worked in their canteens, things like that, even though their offices had now closed and these people weren't needed. So that was one example. There are also companies who've taken the lead when it comes to valuing care and kindness, which of course are traits which neoliberalism really actively ignored. And for example, Cisco, which has been voted as the world's best company to work for, I was fascinated to learn that Cisco has in place and has had for some time a scheme called Tokens of Appreciation, whereby any employee at any level in the company can nominate someone else for what's called a token of appreciation. And the recipient is given a cash award, which can go as high as a few thousand dollars, simply for being kind, for helping. So a company that's kind of saying, you know what, these values actually make a difference. So I think there are things that we can do. There are things that business leaders can do. And when it comes to rethinking capitalism, of course, there are things that governments also need to do. And, you know, New Zealand Premier Jacinda Ardern, of course, is now fated across the world for how brilliantly she handled her country's coronavirus. But she's been pretty forward thinking in other ways too. And last year she announced that New Zealand's budget, for example, was now going to include factoring in effects of policies on people's well-being and actually also how lonely they felt. But of course, loneliness isn't just about feeling isolated, as I said, it's also about feeling unseen and unheard and being ignored. So governments who are serious about rethinking capitalism and bringing people back together again in a world that's fractured and divided will also need to listen to and address the often legitimate concerns many people have had in it, that they have been left out and left behind at a time when inequality continued to rise dramatically, and many people felt very worried about their own jobs, their own futures, and their own economic prospects.
Well, I think it should be required reading. We've your book I'm talking about, because we've sort of skimmed across it with an aerial view of the subject matter, but and zoomed in on a few places. But There's a huge scale to it, and I really enjoyed reading it, and I've really enjoyed talking to you today, Narina. Thanks for sharing your OMI with Bookomi.
Thank you, Rich.
Narina's book, The Lonely Century, Coming Together in a World That's Pulling Us Apart, is available to buy now. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. Meanwhile, if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our most wanted email at bookomi.com. Leaders who are readers can join our preview panel to help us curate our most wanted list of new nonfiction every month. If you enjoyed this Bookomi pod, please follow us on @Bookomi on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Kilgariff. Stay safe, stay together, and remember, everyone feels lonely from time to time. It's what makes us all human after all. Bye for now.